Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before we get going, Helen, this week, we should remind everyone that we are hosting our first These Times live event on April the 8th, and it's here at the Unheard Studios in Westminster.
Yep, we're very excited about doing a live event for the first time, and we're going to be talking about the Middle East. We're going to try to bring together the threads that we've been discussing since the 7th of October in particular. And the title then is War and Peace in the Middle East.
Please follow the link in the episode bio to buy tickets. Really looking forward to it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTague.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
Over the past few months, we've covered many of the big geopolitical stories facing the world today. The crisis in the Middle East, the war in Ukraine, the apparent American retreat from Europe, and the deep structural challenges facing much of Western Europe today. But what we haven't yet covered is one country that's party to all of these issues, and that country is Turkey.
So the question for today's episode is, how and why is Turkey so important in the geopolitics of the 21st century?
The military leader who won his country's freedom, then built and ruled a modern Turkey, is dead. Under Ataturk's 15-year rule, Constantinople was renamed Istanbul.
Turkey's Ottoman past influences the decisions of its current leader, whose ambition is to make the country a global force again.
Today, the Turkish Armed Forces is the second largest army in the military alliance. Turkey and Russia formally launched TurkStream, the second major gas pipeline carrying natural gas to Europe through Turkey.
Unfortunately, such attacks from Syria on our country have now brought the matter to a head. Now it is the end, we say. This needs to end here.
Erdogan has won another 5 years in power.
I don't have hope anymore. I don't have hope for Turkey.
I think it was an unjust election because the country is in a bad situation. I pray to God that he's going to be good for everyone.
Yani güvenmemen için hiçbir sebep yok.
I have no reason not to trust them. To the extent the West is reliable, Russia is equally reliable. For the last 50 years, we have been waiting at the doorstep of the EU, and at this moment in time, I trust Russia just as much as I trust the West.
So Helen, when I was trying to think about why Turkey was so important, because I think in my childhood or much of my life, it hasn't felt like it's a key country for some reason when it clearly is. And thinking about what Harry Truman said when he was asked about why Turkey is so important for American strategy, and he said, look at a map. And I think that seems to be the most obvious place to start. You have, I mean, it sits in partly in Europe, mostly in Asia. It connects the Black Sea with the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles. It obviously faces into the Middle East. It faces into the old kind of Russian world, and it faces into the Balkans. And that is the reason why ultimately America sought to bring Turkey into NATO in the early 50s. It protected Turkey as well as Greece in 46-47. That's the beginning of the Truman Doctrine, which in some senses I think made the modern world. It gives us the American presence in Europe as Britain retreats from Greece. So that to me is where we still are. It hasn't shifted. That is the reason why we need to pay so much attention to Turkey. Just look at a map. And that is why it's a kind of, as well as gives Erdogan, the current president of Turkey, such a hold over European politics as well, because it's the migration route through to Europe. It's a transit route for trade, for energy. And so we can't not deal with Turkey. And of course, there are huge American bases in Turkey. So it's an incredibly important position. But what is interesting with Turkey, it's in NATO. And we've talked about this tension before when it comes to Ukraine and others. It's in NATO, but it's not in the EU.
Absolutely. And I think that it's important to see, in terms of what we want to talk about, how the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War actually makes Turkey even more important. And that might seem paradoxical, given what you've just said, Tom, about the importance of bringing Turkey into NATO back in 1952. But I think it's also significant to see that in those last years of the Cold War, so 1987, Turkey applied to join the European Community, as it then was. Yeah. It had associate membership, or applied for associate membership, I think, back in 1963. And at the center of that question was the issue of being part of the customs union. But 1987, still in the Cold War world, is the beginning of a story that you could say is still unresolved, though I think we now know what the outcome is.
Yeah.
It's unresolved formally of whether Turkey is going to join the European Union, as it would be after 1991, after the Maastricht Treaty. And what I think we can see is the way in which that story plays out rather differently in the world where there is no longer the Soviet Union than it had before 1991. And in order to tell that story, I think we need to see not how Turkey's geography changed with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, because obviously countries' geographies don't change in a year, but the politics of Turkey's geography changed because the dissolution of the Soviet Union meant that Turkey now had borders with Azerbaijan, with Armenia and Georgia. So that's the Caucasus and Central Asia coming into play here. Now, I think that that would have mattered in any sense, because I think that you could say that with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, then the way in which Turkey was now perceived was that it would be, as it had been under the Ottomans, a bulwark against the spread of Russian influence back into that post-Soviet space. At the same time, though, it was made even more important than I think it would have been anyway by the fact that in the late Soviet era, then oil and gas had been discovered in the Caspian Sea, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. And that right from the beginning, there was the hope that Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan would become American allies and would be selling that oil and gas to Western countries. But because the Caspian Sea is landlocked, that meant that constructing pipelines to take this oil and gas was incredibly difficult. And the oil one, which the Clinton administration spent a lot of time on in the 90s, to go through to the Mediterranean was going to have to go through Turkey, and it was going to have to go through Georgia. And that, I think, made both Georgia and Turkey more important than they would otherwise have been.
It's like there's the sort of shutters coming up when you talk there, Helen, about, because you're mentioning all of these countries that then become so important. You know, Georgia and Kazakhstan today, Azerbaijan, and all of the issues that are going on, and the joint exercises that take place in that part of the world between Turkey and Russia. I spent a week in Kyrgyzstan a couple of years ago, and what was noticeable there was that Turkey was there. There was a presence. There was a kind of, because it saw a kind of ethnic kinship in Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia, deep into Central Asia, and also there's obviously a huge Russian presence and a Chinese presence. So you see these different worlds kind of coming together. So it's religious, it's ethnic, it's kind of spheres of influence, and then it's like this raw politics or geopolitics of energy, sort of clashing together.
Completely. I think you could say that what the dissolution of the Soviet Union does in this respect is to turn the Caspian Sea and Central Asia into a site of geopolitical competition.
Yes.
And usually that will be taken as a story about the US and Russia, and then in time, China. But I think Turkey is very much part of that from the start, and intensified by the fact that for the Clinton administration, which is the one that's dealing with this issue and the possibilities of essentially developing Caspian Sea energy is that they have to work out a way of having a constructive relationship with the Turkish government to allow those pipelines to be built. And we need to remember that this is the world still in which the United States is the largest oil importer in the world. We're not living in the shale world mm-hmm. in the 1990s. There seems something in material energy terms at stake for the United States here. And if we bring the European Union question into it, we can see that for the European Union, then the question of what to do about Turkey, when you actually now have really substantial American pressure to bring Turkey into the European Union, becomes a much harder question than dealing with the Turkey issue in the pre-1991 period.
I'm just casting my mind back to the world that I was so familiar with, where psychologically it's one of American Western dominance, where Turkey isn't perhaps not seen as a kind of great power in any way, or even a sort of necessarily a middle-ranking power. It's a kind of transit power. Like this client state that's kind of part of the West. That's how we see it. So bring it in, and Europe feels rich and powerful at that time, and we're concerned about bringing energy in from this part of the world that used to be dominated by Russia. So Russia's weak. The Middle East is obviously chaotic, but not powerful, I don't think. And that seems to be different now to me. That seems to be something that has shifted, in which Turkey is a much more powerful actor.
It is, but I think in order to see that, we first need to see the way in which the Americans really pressurized the Europeans about the Turkey question. Now, Turkey will then come back and stand up to the United States yes. in an important respect. But if we stay in the 90s for a moment, I think the really crucial few years is the last 2-3 years of that decade. So in, I think it was December 1997, the European Union decided not to give applicant status to Turkey.
Yeah.
And this is a point, remember, in which the enlargement of the European Union to bring in Eastern European states. So the 8 states that were joined in 2004 is underway. And you see really clearly that, particularly actually in Germany, where mm-hmm. at that point the Christian Democrats were still in power, that the language used to justify that exclusion of Turkey was civilizational.
Yeah.
I think it was Kohl, so Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who said at that point that the EU was based on Christian principles. And if that's the case, then clearly if Christianity and Europe go together, then there isn't any place for Muslim Turkey in it. But the Americans, and this is Bill Clinton at this point, is horrified by this language that's coming out of Europe at the end of the 1990s. I don't think it's got anything to do with civilization.
Yep.
And you could also say, I don't think they really understand that actually that the European Union is a deep integration project. So they just kind of think of it as bringing Turkey in economically, like you're just sorting out trade between the European Union and Turkey. They don't think of it as Turkey being a large state that would completely change the balance of power, political power within the European Union.
I think our understanding, Helen, in Britain is shallow as well, because we are supporting that American case at that time. And we would do all the way until the Brexit referendum. Tony Blair is supporting it. Gordon Brown, David Cameron would support it. None are talking in these civilizational terms. They're talking about, because it's part of this, let's make Europe shallower and wider, and let's bring Turkey in for that reason. We would quite like to see Turkish weight thrown around in the European Union. But push comes to shove, that changes.
It did, but partly it is because the Clinton administration succeeds in making the European Union reverse course. And this is actually interesting if we think of this as a long-term story about European weakness in relation to American power. Because it's not really the way in that this period, as I would say, usually cast in terms of European weakness. But in 1999, the European Union reverses course. Now, the German government, particularly after Angela Merkel comes into power in 2005, is very reluctant to pursue these negotiations with any seriousness. But formally, they are happening. And this is when you start to see, I'd say particularly under Cameron, a push on the British side of like saying, yes, we should be supportive of Turkey's membership of the European Union. And one of the reasons why, on top of the let's dilute the European Union motive here, is because the British, and they're not alone in this, because I think some people in the European Commission who are thinking about energy think in these terms too, see Turkey as an alternative, not energy provider, because Turkey doesn't have oil and gas, but an alternative energy hub.
Yep.
For bringing in not just oil and gas from the Caspian Sea states, but from the Middle East and from Iran too, because there's still considerable hope that mm-hmm. Iran is an alternative to Russia as an energy provider. And one of the things that's interesting about this is the fact that all these questions about dependency upon Russian gas and oil are already in play at this point, like in the early 2000s, let alone later in the decade. But we can see, I think, that the resistance within a number of European Union states, including France, as well as Germany, mm-hmm. Austria, I think it's quite important in this respect, to Turkish accession is really quite fierce. And I think it's important to see that in the middle of the 2000s, it isn't just actually about the EU fault line coming into clear vision. It's about NATO mm-hmm. as well, because you could tell the story that says, look, the Americans are all about NATO, the European Union's about itself, and the Americans are trying to get these two things joined up. But yep. Turkey is not a straightforward member of NATO either.
No, it's and what that becomes most apparent in was the second Gulf War, the Iraq War, when Turkey by this point is no longer that kind of secular society, or obviously secular society that it was, because Erdogan's party has taken power at this point, formally
2002.
And Erdogan's party is an Islamist party, at least in rhetoric. And the Turkish parliament actually doesn't allow America to use Turkey for its operations in Iraq. Now, that's a big moment, because in one sense, is it fulfilling its obligations as a member of NATO? And what does that do to the American mindset about Turkey's importance, or indeed to Western Europe's mindset, to Britain's? If it's not going to play its role, if it's one of its key roles, then is its importance weakened in our view?
I think not for the first time, the question of what the relationship is between NATO and the Middle East is really brought into focus by a Turkey question. Because if you go back to the introduction of Turkey into NATO in 1952, it's really about a set of issues that are arising in the Middle East, sort of added into how do you actually, if you've got to go to war with the Soviet Union, engage in the Black Sea, if you're not going to have Turkey in your military alliance.
It's kind of helped stopping the Soviet Union from getting into the Middle East. That's the key. So Turkey joins NATO because it's helpful to us to face the Soviet Union. But then Turkey has its own concerns, which aren't ours. So that's the complicating factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that the Americans can't basically have a northern front in the second Iraq war is, I think, of some military significance to the way in which that war plays out. Not in its initial phase, obviously, in terms of the removal from power of, or the end of the death of Saddam Hussein. But just as importantly, I think, in terms of the politics or the geopolitics of Turkey around the second Iraq war, is the fact that in that build-up to the war, that the French, the Germans and the Belgians make clear that they do not see Turkey as a state that needs to be defended by NATO in the wake of an attack on Turkey as a consequence of the conflict.
I think that's an amazing moment. Don't you think that's an amazing moment? Because it's, you think about today and you think about Donald Trump and saying that America wouldn't go to war to defend countries that didn't pay their way as he sees it. Well, here we are, Western countries saying the same about a NATO member. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference between those two positions? They're evidently the same. Like, do you believe in NATO or not? And Turkey is a member of NATO. Whether you see it in civilizational terms as the same thing, well, it's a member. So do we go to war to protect Turkish interests if it is attacked or not? It's interesting why that isn't seen as undermining NATO as much as, if Estonia is attacked. But it evidently doesn't cause the same controversy.
Interestingly as well, if you go back to the first Iraq war, you have some, I think, German reluctance, shall we say, with the idea that Turkey should be defended if Iraq were to attack Turkey. Now, you can see in relation to the second Iraq war that the French, German and Belgian position is also bound up with their opposition to the war in Iraq. And obviously there is a profound division within the European Union more generally about that war. But the fact that this issue is turning up in the first Gulf War is I think, like, quite revealing. And I think it's also true, actually, that there was some reluctance from these countries back in 1952 to have Turkey in NATO.
Because, yeah, they would like the Americans in Europe to protect their interests, but they're not that interested in being part of a much wider global kind of geopolitical game that they don't play, which is the American game. So do we have, what are our responsibilities over there? God, they don't seem like our national responsibilities.
Yeah, but you could argue that even that's a kind of quite tenuous argument, because if you think back to the reason why Turkey is in NATO in 1952 as keeping the Soviets out of the Middle East, then the Germans, certainly the West Germans as they then are, certainly have deep energy interests in the Middle East at that point. Indeed, it's not quite ever gone away. I think it's revealing of the more general difficulty that the United States and the European states had, and collectively within NATO, of like thinking about what that NATO-Middle East relationship is about. I think the other thing we should just finish on this before we get on to Arab uprisings of 2011 and the way that changes things again is that this issue of Turkey being an alternative energy hub to Russia, really, you can see as being pretty significant in the 2010s, because this is a decade, or the first half of the 2010s, I should say, because this is a decade when the desire by a number of European states and the European Commission to find alternatives to not just Russian energy supply, but the existing transit system is pretty acute. And there is this project, it's called the Nabucco project, the Nabucco-like pipeline, which would basically be a means of bringing in gas, in this case, from Azerbaijan and potentially from Iran into Europe. And the Turkish government is absolutely convinced that by supporting the Nabucco pipeline, they are going to have a pathway to European Union membership. And you have the states like Britain, under Cameron, are very keen on this, pushing this project. You have resistance from the states that are less keen, and particularly from the German government, who doesn't have an interest in gas that's coming in, essentially the southern route, if you like, into Europe, because it's moved into taking gas into Germany under the Baltic Sea, and not under the Black Sea.
But Austria are supportive of this move, they are, aren't they? That is an interesting one. I mean, I think so much of this, Helen, comes down to, or is revealing about how geopolitics actually works. So if you think again about Turkey's confidence there that it can use this dependency or this transit power that it has to secure its goals to join the EU. Russia, under Putin, thought that Europe's dependence on Russian gas would mean that it could do what it wanted in Ukraine. There are deeper things at play, though, aren't there? Like ideas of who we are as people that seem to, in some sense, trump these raw power analyses and this, you know, this idea that you can move pieces around on a chessboard, or that Americans can say to Europe, bring Turkey in. And it meets this resistance, which is just imaginative. It's like too many people in Europe don't think that Turkish people are European, and therefore they're not going to let them in. And that's the barrier here. And attempts, even say the British government, to try and get Turkey in, they also then, when it's really put up against a sort of democratic test, they flip. And we'll talk about David Cameron in a minute, but he flips and eventually says, no, Turkey will never join. They won't be in the EU till 3000. Don't worry, voters. I mean, that's just so revealing, and especially Austria, because Austria is quite anti-Turkish. And yet its government here is pursuing this pipeline deal. And so it's like trying to have your cake and eat it, I think. I mean, you can flip this as well, Helen, because if you think about Turkey and its idea of who it is as well, and it has this long-standing commitment to get into the EU. Under Erdogan, who sees himself differently to the sort of Ataturk heirs, the secular leaders of Turkey, he has a pull to the Middle East. And you might see that, say, on the Israel-Gaza issue, where he is fiercely critical of Israel. But Turkey has had good relations with Israel, but they are being torn apart by by ideas of kinship and civilizational ideas that don't just exist in Europe, but exist in the Middle East, and I think would come to the fore in the Arab Spring as well.
Yeah, I think that we can see that Turkey's relationship to the Middle East really interjects itself into all this politics in quite a complicated way that will have some implications for Brexit, because Cameron is caught between the Turkey issue coming from the way we've just been talking about it, but also the migrant and refugee crisis from 2015, where the migrants and refugees are coming out of Turkey in Central Europe. I think that there's no doubt that the Arab uprisings of 2011 are kind of a watershed moment for the way in which Turkey interacts with a whole set of issues that then interact back again with the European questions. I mean, partly because that actually in 2011 that Turkey supports the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
Yeah.
But I think the most significant intervention that Turkey makes is on the Syria question.
Yeah.
And this begins when Turkey supports the Free Syrian Army against Assad. Now, obviously, at that point, that this is a position that's supported by the United States, it's supported by the British government. But by the time we get to like 2016, where, as we've talked about really on multiple times now, that the Americans and the British have retreated from the position that they've been taking on Syria after the decision by Obama not to attack Syria on the chemical weapons issue in 2013, that Turkey begins a military intervention in Syria in 2016. And partly that's directed against ISIS, and partly it's directed against a Kurdish group in Syria. And that has led to what is really the occupation of northwest Syria by Turkey to this day. And this caused all kinds of complications then for how the Americans, both under Obama and under Trump, can deal with the Syria question. Because when Obama decides to go into Syria against ISIS in 2014, then he does absolutely not want actual American troops on the ground in Syria. So that means in terms of on the ground, somebody else has got to do the fighting. That turns out to be the Kurdish groups, which then antagonizes deeply Erdogan, who sees these Turkish groups as terrorists.
And hostile to Turkish interests. It's quite an interesting question, isn't it, about what would be considered consistent Western policy here? Because Obama is taking a decision to arm a group of people that a NATO ally considers terrorists and a threat. That would be and was considered hostile in Ankara, led to a Turkish response.
Yeah, because they don't want... I think there's a point in 2014 where they stop the Americans using the air bases against ISIS because of the fact that the Americans are backing the Kurdish groups.
Yeah, and then Trump does something which is to reverse this, which is effectively to give Turkey carte blanche to do what it wants against the Kurds. And that was considered, you know, understandably so, morally so, perhaps, an appalling thing to do, is betrayal of our allies, our Western allies. But again, it's kind of putting to one side the fact that Turkey are formally our allies. They are in NATO. We have bases, the Americans have bases there, and they have nuclear weapons stationed in Turkey. Now, this is a crucially important piece of territory. So which one of Obama and Trump is kind of breaking with the formal Western policy? It's not entirely clear which one is taking a different tack. And I think, again, it's revealing because it's over this question that brings Macron into the game, furious at Turkey and America's behavior and the priorities that they're revealing. And it's this that sparks what we've talked about before, where he says that NATO is suffering a brain death and then questions whether Turkey should even be in NATO. I think he's asked this question directly, isn't he?
He is. He's asked whether he's suggesting that, I think it's even in the Economist interview itself where he says about the brain death, he's asked whether he believes that Turkey didn't belong in NATO in the long term, and he answered, "I couldn't say."
Hardly a ringing endorsement, is it? It's not that that's like an illegitimate position, but it's a radical position, and it's not the position that's existed, and it comes with dramatic implications for for Western power and Western geopolitics, because Turkey, going back to that map point, you know, of Truman, it's still the same place in the map. It's still incredibly important, and it continues to be. It's become more important actually since.
Yeah, you can see, I think, that the Germans try to resolve the issue. I think it's the German parliament in 2017 actually resolves to leave the German forces will leave the big Turkish air base, and they redeployed, I think, to Jordan. But I think that by the time you get to the end of the Trump presidency, that this issue just hasn't been like resolved at all. And it's then compounded on the Macron side of it by the fact that what we see like through 2020 is another flashpoint. There's actually another flashpoint, which we haven't got time to talk about, going on in Libya, where Turkey has also intervened. But what we see, I think, particularly in 2020 is a set of quite confrontational moves that Erdogan makes in terms of sending Turkish vessels guarded by Turkish naval ships with Ottoman names into Cypriot and Greek waters. And what all this is about is the gas that had been discovered in the Eastern Mediterranean in the early 2010s, and that Turkey had effectively been shut out of these gas developments. And for Erdogan, that was, I think it's fair to say, like existential for Turkey. It goes back to Turkey's perception of its own history in terms of the way in which at the end of the First World War, with the end of the Ottoman Empire and the presence of Britain and France in former Ottoman territory, particularly British in Mesopotamia, that they were shut out, that Turkey, the new independent Turkish state from 1923, was shut out of those energy developments. And then Turkey is claiming waters where this gas has been discovered as Turkish. And this really antagonises Macron again. He responds to the moves, you know, by giving rousing declarations of support for Greece and Cyprus, and I think at one point sending some French ships into the Eastern Mediterranean too.
Is this because, is he claiming, Erdogan, that this is Turkish gas because it's around Cyprus? That's the...
Yeah, I mean, there's the central conflict here is around the waters. There is issues about the Greek waters too. And you can see, I think that there's another complication here that we haven't got time to get into, because we need to get to how things change again with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is there's a whole set of issues around the Turkey-Libya relationship in the civil war in Libya and Turkish intervention in that, the Libyan government that Turkey is supporting being willing to draw up maritime borders in the East Mediterranean that are quite useful for Turkey, and that setting off the Greeks of making an arrangement with the Egyptian government about also like maritime borders. And from Macron's point of view, he thinks of this, I think, as territorial revisionism coming out of Ankara, and he's very, very unhappy about it. But I think, and this is where we should take a break, is that whilst there's a certain coherence to Macron's position on this, what happens when Russia invades Ukraine in February 2022 really resets the Turkey question.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back, everyone. Well, in that first half, we managed to get from Harry Truman to 2022. So we covered quite a bit there. I mean, I think what we finished with was a certain sense of incoherence about NATO in a way, and this sort of breakdown that you were explaining towards the end there, Helen, with, you know, the France considering warships to the East Mediterranean against a fellow NATO ally, talking about the brain death of NATO because of these conflicts in northern Syria. And this sense that Turkey and NATO members weren't any longer sharing these same kind of existential interests. But then what changes in February 2022 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine is it's almost like a reminder of the original purpose of Turkey's membership of NATO, that it's there on the map, boxing in the Soviet Union and now Russia. And you start to see this more and more as the war goes on, the importance of Turkey. Just let's take one example, the grain deal that is struck early on, where Turkey is a necessary signature to this because it controls the waters to get the grain out of Ukraine through the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean, out into the world. So Turkey's importance becomes clear, and then it stayed important. And you see those other issues seem to fade now into the background because of the rise of the existential issue at the centre.
Yeah, it isn't actually just the Syria issue that is making Turkey's membership of NATO more complicated. It's also what happens after the attempted coup in Turkey in July of 2016, where Erdogan's belief, rightly or wrongly, is that he's better supported by Putin than he is by the United States and European Union states. And so you start to see a set of moves that Erdogan himself makes in terms of like buying Russian weapons, a Russian missile defense system in 2019. As a response to that, Trump put sanctions on the Turkish government and removed it from the F-35 jet program. So,
and this was coinciding with lots of economic difficulties.
Absolutely,
that was going through. Yeah.
Absolutely, and I think we mentioned some of those when we were talking about the French like German relationship, where at the same time where Macron is very antagonistic over the East Mediterranean, the German government, although it's got no interest in Turkey coming into the European Union, is willing to provide financial support to Turkey. Germany is pretty important as a trading partner for Turkey. So there's a lot going on here. And the drift, you can say, is to say that Turkey's membership of NATO looks incoherent, as you said, in multiple ways.
Yeah.
But for the very reason that you said, the war changes it, both because under the Montreux Convention that goes back to 1936, is it's Turkey that gets to decide when war has happened in the Black Sea and then can make decisions about whose navies can enter the Black Sea. But just as importantly, Turkey had been providing particular kind of drones to Ukraine in the build-up to the war, and that these drones turn up to be extraordinarily important in the first months of the war in defending Ukraine. So as the war goes on, Erdogan matters in terms of the grain deal, but I think he matters a lot militarily in terms of the initial weeks when Ukraine's survival as an independent nation state seemed very much in question.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we talk about the incoherence of NATO in a very obvious sense, but when you were saying there about Erdogan feeling that he was more supported in Moscow than he was in Western capitals because there was this difficulty in deciding, I guess, was the coup something that was to stop a kind of increasingly authoritarian Islamist president? So in some senses, was it a liberal coup, even though it was autocratic and anti-democratic? So that lack of clarity from the West about what this thing was then obviously plays into Erdogan's mind, because instead of just saying it's a coup against an ally, of course we don't support it, you know, that's offering that clarity. I think you get something similar, and we've touched upon this with Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and you get these reports back now saying that this was really felt in Saudi Arabia, that they felt that they didn't have the support of the West in a key war, and they are making decisions subsequently as a result of that. So it's Western incoherence as well here, that's an important part of this story, that we are shifting in our notion sort of back and forth about what it is we're supporting, what is the core thing that's holding us and our allies together.
Yeah, I think, and I know we're now delaying getting to Ukraine again or moving away from it, but we will get back to it. I think there's a really interesting example of what you've just said there, Tom, which is the way in which Merkel deals with the Turkey question in 2015, 16, 17. Because if you go back to that time in which she is basically saying that as many refugees and migrants as want to come to Germany can come, she then loses her nerve completely about that because of the domestic political reaction. And then her interest is in basically trying to get a European Union level deal to keep the refugees in Turkey. And remember that these are refugees that have come fundamentally out of the Syrian civil war, and there are large refugee camps in Turkey. And you can see that Erdogan at various times makes threats against European states by saying, I'll let loose the refugees onto you. But what's notable is that Merkel, effectively with Mark Rutte, I think it was, who was the Dutch prime minister then, and who, and I think the Dutch then were holding the presidency of the European Union, effectively makes a bilateral agreement with, in the name of the EU, but it is a Merkel deal. This is in, I think, the spring of 2016. And it essentially means that the accession negotiations that have stalled for all the reasons that we've already talked about have to have some, shall we just say, energy put back in them again. And for Cameron, that's a nightmare-like scenario, because by this point he's into, oh, of course I don't support Turkish membership for the European Union. But then the attempted coup is in July of 2016. And because of the way then that Erdogan domestically reacts to that, then there's a reaction in terms of being more, some authoritarian moves that again makes it more difficult for these accession negotiations to go anywhere. And by the time you get to the German election of 2017, Merkel's having to say, actually, no, Turkey can't be part of the European Union. By 2018, she's exasperated with Macron about his growing confrontation, or certainly by 2019, his growing confrontation with Erdogan. So there's it's very difficult to tell a coherent like story through that. But I think that what the Russian invasion of Ukraine does is basically to bring all that in a way to like a halt. It's kind of like the, as you said, look at the map moment.
Again. Yeah, and he becomes an important player. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he's able to play these games that he's doing, where he has taken a lesson that he got more support from Moscow, but at the same time he's selling drones to Ukraine. There were potential kind of conflict moments, weren't there, in the Syrian civil war, when there was Russian and Turkish planes were getting, I think there was a downing of a plane at one moment, but they didn't explode into life, because I mean that's a dangerous moment. You think, again, Turkey is a NATO member, and there's just been a downing of a plane with Russia. That's a potentially disastrous moment, but it doesn't go anywhere. And today, as well, in the war in Ukraine, Erdogan has maintained relations with Putin, and he hasn't chosen a side, has he? He hasn't come out on one side or another.
Well, I think you could say he's backing both sides. I mean, it might be the other way of putting it.
Right,
on the sense of the militarily, I think that Turkey has made a significant difference to Ukraine, I'd say, particularly early on. It's provided that lifeline on grain at a point when Ukraine was in a very weak position in the Black Sea, which is no longer the case. That's why I think the Ukraine can survive without a new grain deal. But if we look at it in terms of the sanctions side, then Turkey has not been willing to back US-led sanctions, EU sanctions. So Turkey is dependent still, as dependent, at least as dependent as it was on Russian energy imports before the war. Indeed, you might argue, if you look at some of the data, that actually Turkey has been acting as a kind of like recycling hub, ironically given past history, for Russian oil and gas coming into Europe.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we've talked about this a few times, and we've used this word, the like incoherence. And you see such obvious incoherence in the Western response to the war and to previous conflicts, as we've discussed, that you have Turkey here, this NATO member who's not part of the EU, and the fact that that is a key problem in Eastern Europe. It's a key problem with Ukraine, the fact that it's an aspirant EU member. But its aspirations to join NATO are much more distant. And that sort of that gap between EU membership and NATO membership is a sort of core source of instability and incoherence across the border with Russia, same with Georgia previously. But here is Turkey, a member of NATO, but not of the EU, that is not joining in the Western effort to box in Russia economically. But maybe that's what geopolitics is. It is incoherent. That's kind of the point. Like, that's the world. It's the mess. And I suppose this is the realist argument. Although I think, as I said in the first half, I think where the realist argument falls flat is on this question of identity and ideas. And I think that seems to be so crucial. It's a crucial part of this story. It's a crucial part of Russia's actions, Turkey's actions. It's like, who do they think they are? And who do they think, which countries do they think belong to them?
But you could argue, though, that if you look at it from Turkey's point of view under Erdogan, that at least for the first 10 years or maybe longer, 15 years, is that the material attractions of the European Union were being put before any questions about, like, identity. And that so far as he's gone off, moved into that direction, it could be seen as a reaction to the way in which identity and civilizational arguments were being used within the European Union itself. I think you're right, though, in the sense that a lot of the time that the geopolitics of this have just been like muddling through.
Yeah.
And that each time it looks like there's something that potentially irrevocable happening, that each side, if there are, or the multiple sides, like pull back from it. And another example of that, I think, would be the way in which Turkey mattered once Russia had invaded Ukraine and Finland and Sweden wanted to join NATO and their neutrality or their formal neutrality anyway. And initially, particularly in relation to Sweden, Erdogan looked like he was willing to veto that. But once concessions were offered, including some economic concessions and the possibility of getting back into American defense programs that it had been excluded from because of buying from the Russians, then things move. And as we know, Sweden has joined NATO. And I think that at the heart of this is that it's very, very difficult for the NATO to be a coherent political actor when it faces the multiple problems in which it does. And the really baked in from the start of NATO's history is this not really knowing what to do about the Middle East question. And I think if we then turn to what's gone on in the Middle East in the last few years and the present crisis in the Middle East resulting first and foremost, as we know from the Israel-Hamas war, is these questions are to the fore again. And at the same time, Turkey has a set of dilemmas as in this time as a Muslim state, but a Sunni Muslim state, as to how to deal with Israel and how to deal with the Palestinian question and how at the same time to look after its own energy interests in the region.
Yeah, it's hard to quite grasp sort of Turkey's power when you try and assess all of these stories, because you see that story about Finland and Sweden and you almost wonder, is Turkey like a giant Hungary in this sense that it sort of talks tough but ultimately can be bargained with and it will strike a deal? And in this case it struck a deal and it got its F-35 contract back. But then maybe that's the nature of geopolitics and diplomacy, and it's not that it's a giant Hungary, it's just that it is powerful, and it managed to leverage its position in NATO to extract big concessions that will make it more powerful and will maintain its power. And that's an important part of its Turkey's story, and it's not going away. The fact that it's a transit country for trade matters. It matters when you're thinking about Indian trade to Europe or Chinese trade to Europe, gas coming in from Central Asia. You cannot ignore Turkey. And then I think we discussed this in our episode on Africa, where Turkish power is evidently creeping across Africa.
And or West Africa anyway.
West Africa. And then it's there in Libya and Cyprus. And, you know, this is a particularly powerful state. So the way we're thinking about it is having to change as a result. I mean, with Britain no longer in the EU, there doesn't seem any push now to have Turkey as a member of the EU. And as you say, it's almost like Erdogan reacts against the rejection by saying, well, you know, we're not going to pursue it, but you're going to have to deal with us and we're going to extract concessions from you.
Yeah, and I think if we look at it from the Turkish government's point of view for the moment, at least in an analytical sense, is that we can see that it is being hit by events. Mm. And so in the same way in which the US and Europe and NATO collectively are. And I think that the Israel-Hamas wars are like a very good example of that, because one of the things that Turkey had been doing from 2022, so really in the same year as things are changing in the big geopolitical picture for Turkey, was that it had re-established diplomatic relations with Israel after a four-year break in them, which had come about in relation to the shooting of some Palestinians in Gaza. And so you can say, I think, that Turkey was part of that shift towards normalization, at least of some relations between some Muslim states and Israel. So from the Abraham Accords, as we've talked about, through to what was going on with the discussions between Saudi Arabia and the Biden administration about normalizing relations with Israel. And then comes Hamas's attack on Israel on the 7th of October of last year. And then the Turkish government is in a very different position. And part of the reason why it's in a very different and difficult position is because Israel had become a state that was dependent upon oil transit through Turkey. Because as we've talked about before, I think when we were talking about Israel's relations with Iran, you go back to the 1970s, then Iran was the state that was providing most of Israel's oil in the difficult energy situation that Israel faced. The state that's now providing two-thirds of it is Azerbaijan, which goes back to the landlocked Caspian Sea issue, which goes back to that pipeline that the Clinton administration supported being built, as we were talking about in the first half, which ran through Georgia and Turkey and supplies Israel. Now, although Erdogan's obviously been very critical of the Israeli government, he hasn't made any move to shut off transit through the pipeline.
So, I mean, do you think when you look at this world, that picture that you've painted there, Helen, that I wonder whether Turkey's position is sort of structurally powerful in that, you know, it sits at this nexus and therefore it will remain powerful. But also it makes me think that so much depends on the outcome of this war between Russia and Ukraine. And that we often think about it here in Western Europe as mattering because it will then have an effect on the Baltics or Belarus, or it'd have all of these huge knock-on effects into Europe. But it has knock-on effects into that other part of the old Russian world, the Central Asia, and that part of the world that we're talking about, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan. You know, Russia's power, how Russia emerges as a power, and its ability to reimpose some kind of control over its sphere of influence, will have dramatic effects on Turkish power, and then on the Middle East as well, because it's all connected. But if Russia emerges as a defeated, weakened state, and that those parts of the world that we talked about right the way back in the 1990s, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, all of those can emerge as pro-Western independent states with oil and gas that transited out into the, you know, then that's a world that we're more familiar with of the 1990s and of Western power. But actually, if Russia is able to force itself back into a more great power status, we do emerge into a world of great powers. There's every chance that Turkey will be one of those. It has a lot of tools.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really crucial to the geopolitical ramifications in the medium to long term of Russia's war is what happens to the balance of power in the Black Sea. And we've talked about this in other contexts directly in relation to Ukraine, because at the moment, Ukraine has been pushing back really quite successfully in the Black Sea, including driving the Russian naval force out of Sevastopol, whilst obviously on land, Ukraine has not had a very good 9 months or so. But if you were to see an outcome where Russia was pushed away from the Black Sea, then that leaves Turkey as really very much the dominant power, not just in the formal sense of the Montreux Convention, but more than that. And then you might start actually getting worries about Turkey in that respect. And I think so long as the Russia question like dominates, the question of like what Turkey's maritime ambitions are is a bit below the surface, so to speak.
Yeah.
But if that no longer turns out to be the case, then I think things change there. And it's also notable, and this goes obviously to the Middle East conflict, is that Turkey is also making moves in the Red Sea, where this is obviously not a literal state. So even just in the course of this year, it's agreed a defence pact with Somalia. It's worked on an energy exploration deal. It's actually already had a military base there. It's supplanted the United Arab Emirates, where there had been a proposed defence pact that fell through last year. So Turkey's involving itself in quite a lot of different places in the waters of Eurasia, if we think about it in that sense. I mean, the inner waters, if we could call it that, not the oceans.
Well, in some sense, Helen, the coherence of the West and of NATO relies on a strong Russia to some extent. It becomes more coherent the weaker Russia becomes. So if Russia emerges as a defeated and weakened power, Turkey emerges as a stronger power and it starts to use that power as it will, then the fears of the Western mind will turn to this new power, you know, the re-emerging Ottoman
and
Empire.
And obviously that's partly where Macron had already gone, but then had to retreat when essentially Turkish indispensability to defending Ukraine came into view. And given that Macron has now moved to, as we know, and talked about a very strong pro-Ukraine position, not where he started the war, then that has to have implications for the way that he can think about the Turkey question.
Yeah, given Macron's record, maybe he was right the first time. His long-term prediction will come to pass. I mean, I think that's a sort of fascinating world. It does make me think that the sort of the ultimate lesson is that, you know, these so striving for coherence is never going to be possible, because you just presented with a fresh challenge. If one power is down, another power will be up, and then your attention will turn another
But
way.
I think it is also in the way in which we've talked about this, and some of the connections that we should have drawn, we probably haven't drawn. In fact, I know that we haven't drawn because we haven't had time to, and particularly I think we've downplayed the Libya issue, is that Turkey is a good way of seeing how all the seemingly different, disparate geopolitical threads actually connect together, and how effects in one have really profound consequences elsewhere.
Exactly. And on that, we should finish this week. That was another sort of mammoth run through history. If you liked it, please do like and share it with your friends, and please do give us a rating, and see you next week.
And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.